This is an oral history of arts educator Mia Gonzalez and lawyer Anna Montano for the Mission Murals Project. I'm Camilo Garzón. It was recorded on the morning of June 24th, 2021, inside of Radio Habana Social Club in the Mission District of San Francisco, California. Once you start listening to the oral history, you'll hear descriptions of pieces of art, keepsakes, and artifacts that are part of the walls of the establishment and add to the texture of the place. The voices you'll hear will be those of Mia, Anna, producer Maisa Plank-Graham, and my own. This oral history delves into the facets of Mia's and Anna's early life, their upbringing, and how they ended up meeting and becoming roommates in San Francisco's Mission District. The personal and political reasons for their focus on establishing Palmy Alley as an art space are clarified as they share their experiences reclaiming space for community, education, and activism. This oral history is a beautiful testament to the role of friendship, partnership, and collaboration in revolution, as well as highlights both Mia Gonzalez's and Anna Montano's respective roles in preserving and amplifying Chicanx and Latinx heritage in San Francisco's Mission District and beyond. Here is the oral history. And I'm recording now. Today is June 24th, and I'm here with Mia Gonzalez, and I am also here with Anna Montano, talking to them on behalf of the Mission Murals Project, and we're talking to them in a very special place. Do you mind both of you describing where you are? Any of you can start.
We're in a wonderful little cafe place, bistro, it would almost call, called Radio Havana. It started with Victor Navarrete, who's a Cuban artist, and his wife, Leila Mansour. And Victor's had been active with the community in his art, and he's more of a sculptor. So the walls are very reflective of his mind in many ways, you know, and his creativity. And one of the back walls he also leaves open for other artists to show their work.
And it's always changing, right? Always evolving.
Always evolving. And before we get into the kind of interesting thing that you just mentioned, which relates very much to murals, which are like ever-changing pieces of art that get contributed to and keep changing, what are some of the things that we're looking at right now?
Well, they're mixed media sculptures, right? They have like a surrealist Dada influence because he mixes different media in very interesting ways, and even hangs it, you know, very interesting. But he also has these assemblage boxes. For instance, I reacted to this one, John Lennon one, because it really captures the, you know, the time, and actually the feeling of when John Lennon was shot. So when I saw the box, I was, you know, kind of taken aback. Oh, yeah. So there, some of them are more lighthearted musicians. He's got a photograph of Keaton here, Marilyn Monroe, artists, musicians. But then others that you're not so sure what they're saying. There's toys, for example, which dolls, clowns. He's got one of Frida, which is beautiful too. I love the way he used that gold with the image, which is, I think, a commercial image. Then he's got Van Gogh way up there after I think he cut his ear.
But he put it in that little mirror box too.
And I think I see the ear.
Yeah, he puts it in there. With the assemblage part.
And then below that we have Picasso with the bike, you call it handles that look
seat,
like a bowl,
seat, yeah.
Which I think is, one of the Dada artists did that. And then Victor put it together in such a strong graphic way.
Yeah, like a bull.
También. Yeah.
Como Pamplona.
I don't know, that might be by Duchamp, actually.
But I just love the way it's reproduced here, right? It really brings everything to life. And the photograph of course, Pablo Picasso, who was, he was very photogenic, I would say.
Yeah.
And then the Campbell's soup, right, by Andy. So it's just, I mean, you could sit here for, it's a museum. Yeah, yeah. It's a museum space almost. You could sit there looking at this artwork for hours.
It's very bohemian.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's like, you know, Hitchcock, James Baldwin, Borges, Gandhi,
yeah.
Bukowski.
Right.
We have you in Santana.
Buster
King.
Yeah, Buster King.
As well, Chekhov, some of the Russians too. So it's very eclectic, be honest.
Right. It's extremely eclectic.
Extremely eclectic.
It's such a beautiful place. Thank you for describing the place for everyone listening. And I would say that the best way of starting here is with each one of your names. So we can go, let's say, first with Mia and then with Anna. Like, say your full name as you want to say it. Because sometimes even myself, like Camilo Garzón, but I happen to also have other last names. And because of the U.S. spectrum of experiences or things we have gotten used to, sometimes we choose to not accentuate things or emphasize certain things. So with that in mind, Mia, do you mind beginning? Tell me your full name and where were you born, and then we'll go with Anna.
Sure. I my name is Mia Galaviz, actually. And I'm a native San Franciscan. I'm a second generation San Franciscan. Gonzalez is my married name. I've been trying to not have Gonzalez anymore, but it's very difficult to change your last name after you're married. It's, you have to go through a lot of hurdles. So I just go Galaviz de Gonzalez. So I maintain that name for a very, very, very long time.
Thank you for sharing that.
Sure.
Anna.
Sí, yo me llamo Ana Margarita Montano Herrera Mora. I was born in El Salvador, but I immigrated with my mother back in the late 50s when she came. She was quite a pioneer. My cousin used to call her the Christopher Columbus of the family because she came to California. She didn't know anyone. And she was telling me, you know, she says, I don't know what I thought I was going to do as soon as I arrived. She didn't know anyone. She didn't have a place to stay. And she actually met a friend at the airport when she was leaving El Salvador. And my aunt said to the friend, would you please take care of my niece? So that's the way my mom got established. And she actually moved into 24th Street. And so we arrived to 24th Street back in the day. And I've worked with Mia when I was a young City College student, San Francisco City College, and it was the work study program,
right,
that sent me to work at the center where she was the executive director of a Latino children's tutorial program. They were young children. First grade through, six, seven, eight, maybe?
Yeah, pretty much middle school.
Yeah, so it was an education program. But Mia, being the artist as she has always incorporated art into the children's education and tutorial experience. She really made a great effort to expand like their perspective. I remember that she was trying to get me to go with her on a camping trip with the kids. I don't want to go with all these crazy little kids.
It'll be good for you.
Mia was used to that. You know, she really just went that extra step, and she would take the kids camping at San Gregorio?
Yeah.
On the coast
in
California. And these kids are, you know, from inner city, right? But that was her mindset at the time. And of course, you know, we did a lot of work and we went on to our careers and what have you.
Right.
When you think of these kind of meeting, right, like meeting each other and also the work, I also want you to reflect back on something that I think we don't get asked about as much, which is just our family background, our upbringing, and all of these decisions of even being either, as we call it, native to the mission, but if anything, just like we became part of a place, we own some kind of identity now, thanks to having been in a place. How do you think that kind of background influenced those further decisions and work that you did specifically with children, which we'll get into, as well as Balmy Ali? But what's the family background, and what are some things that you remember even of your parents, your, if you had siblings, and those kinds of things that you want to say?
Well, for me, being a second generation San Franciscan, and my grandmother who came, she was the one and only daughter of seven brothers. So they lived in the state of Chihuahua, from Mexico, and her family wanted to marry her off to a very wealthy land baron, and she just wasn't going to have that because she says, oh, no, I'm too young and he's too old and I'm not going to do that. So she and a girlfriend of hers escaped and they hopped on a train, which Anna and I have done too, but that's a different story, different time. And they jumped on a train and left for Chihuahua to come to California, same reason. My grandmother had a brother in Los Angeles somewhere. And she went to Los Angeles and she came to San Francisco. Unfortunately for me, as trying to get my family history, the family were at a point in their life, so they didn't really want to talk about how they left, how she got from LA to San Francisco. But my grandmother never spoke English, and she only spoke Spanish, and she, like many immigrant women, tried to look for a place to live and a place to work. So my grandmother was more of, she worked as a seamstress. She did get married, and then she had her daughters. She had four daughters. And she lived here. They lived here in what's called it was kind of more a Mexican community in many ways, which is now called Soma, so south of Market. So that was a very large community of Mexicans, actually. And they lived under what's now one of the big ginormous pillars on Clementina Street, where the big pillars are when they established the Bay Bridge. They loved where they lived, but they had to move. So they were forced to evict to live that area. And they found another place, again, part of the South of Market. South of Market had a lot of Mexicans. It was very Latino in that area. So that's where my mother grew up, and then met my dad down the street.
You know, now that you said about the Mexican community in the South Market, which I really didn't know, because when I think my mother came in the late 50s, that may have dissipated.
Yeah.
But I remember that there was one Mexican shop. On Market and Six and Market. It was there for years.
Yeah.
And they were the only shop that had Mexican goods like jewelry, clothing.
Yeah.
But I think that was it. That was the only one for...
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And then...
Until the Mexican Museum, I think.
Right.
And Galeria.
And Galeria.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's a different
time. Those were...
Interesting.
I hadn't put those together.
So my family, my uncle had a shop here on 24th Street. We cannot leave.
We cannot
get off 24th Street. For some reason, it's like 24th and 20th are our destination paths. It's bizarre to me, but
yeah.
I know that exactly where I was conceived because my uncle and my aunt and lived with my mother and my father, and it was right across. It was on 20th and New York, right across around the corner from where we lived.
Oh, where we used to live.
We lived on. 20th between New York and Bryant.
Yeah, we were roommates back in the day.
Back in the day. Why was I going to 20th?
Yeah, which is where we took these photographs.
That's right. And so why was I going to 24th Street? I've got one.
Well, okay. You said your uncle had a shop.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. My aging. My uncle Jack had a shop. He was a painter, but he was a sign painter. So he had a shop on 24th near Mission, which is now La Boheme, the coffee house there.
Oh, yeah.
And he, mm-hmm. when you look inside the coffee house, you look inside, it's huge. You can see what was a divisional wall that was divided. He lived on the other side of that. So he actually lived there and he painted his sign. So it was Jack Cavillo's sign painting. So a number of our family members they painted and they doodled, but they never really looked at it as anything that was really particularly important, except for one of the uncles who lived in Tijuana, and he would paint huge murals in bars because he liked to have his refreshments while he was painting. So, and he also painted a huge mural by a bull ring, and then he lived not far from that either. But he was the only one who probably made it more exciting and interesting.
You know what I remember, Mia? Your mother was a seamstress. She was very good. I remember she made some blouses for me.
That's right.
Then I remember she made that Chinese style jacket one time, and then you gave it to me. And it was such a fabulous jacket.
That's funny. I was going to wear a Chinese jacket today.
And then, of course, you're so good at most of what you do. So that kind of artistic, I think...
bent somewhat.
Yeah, just kind of goes through the generations.
Mm-hmm. I think
he is a great artist, right?
I like to play with... I think with our family, in terms of sense of painting or drawing or being creative with a sewing machine, it just was part of what you do.
Yeah.
You know, it was part of, like, any kind of frontiers people, really. You sew and you make things for your family for a variety of reasons. One, there's not a lot of money, and two, there's probably a lot of too many other people in the household. Yeah. So you made ends do. Because what we used to do, how I learned how to embroider, was going with my mother to get the flour sacks and wash them, and there was still lettering on the flour sacks. We learned how to bleach them out, and then we had to learn how to embroider.
Yeah.
There's a wonderful print by
Esther Hernandez.
Yeah.
So Esther is sitting on Esther is a little girl. She might be 2 years old in that photo. It's not a photo. It's a screen print that she created.
She's about three.
So it shows her as a little girl sitting on a bunch of flower sacks.
Uh-huh.
And she was saying that, okay, they would put me, her sisters, older sisters, would put her on the flower sacks, and then they would look to see which flower sack would make a cute dress for her.
And she has this dress, because one of her icon images is a watermelon. So when she showed that her print, when we used to work at Galleria,
it's a beautiful print.
And I just started crying because it touched that spot of knowing what it means to use a flower sack for clothing. And then
aesthetic, you know, vibrant kind of aesthetic and that creativity. And of course, obviously, she was loved because, you know, her sisters, her family bothered too. Hey, let's get the prettiest flower sack.
And the cutest child.
Yeah, and make her a little dress.
She actually gifted me that one, so like I have it now. Gave it to my daughter, and it's so sentimental, you know. So I have to remind my grandson about that story. He doesn't know anything of that stuff at all. It's like, oh,
well,
God.
The other thing too is now. So when I was I was here at school here at Horseman when I was middle school. We used to call it middle school, and there we had homemaking. So we would be taught, we were taught how to make pancakes, for example, you know, like really basic things. And then we had boys had a shop or whatever.
Yeah.
And then when I went to high school, which was actually a Catholic high school, we learned how to sew. And when my cousins, who are, let's say, almost a generation younger than I am, all that got taken away. You know, the homemaking got taken away, the shop got taken away, the music got taken away. I mean, it was tragic.
And dance.
Yeah, but anything that reading, writing, math was
taken away. Anything
that
had to do with creativity and enrichment for a child was completely eliminated. And I think
And parents couldn't afford to. No. I mean, you know, if you're a middle class person, you know, you send your kid to the ballet or to gymnastics or whatever, right? But a lot of the parents here in the community could not afford to do that. Mm-hmm. So I think it really was a great tragedy in terms of the education young people got. And maybe still now, too, it's fairly limited.
Yeah, it really does have that same problem. Mm-hmm. And I think for us, as we, because we had that good fortune, and it was part of just of a naturalness about our how we were educated, because we had all those things in our school. We had that in growing up. And then we also had it in our families. If it wasn't your direct parent, it was somebody else in your family.
Oh, yeah.
Who would say, oh, mija, you know how to do this. Oh, man.
And sometimes you could learn just by observing people, mm-hmm. you know. So what I think happened with that is that we had a way of approaching or looking at issues and, let's say, situations and maybe problems and kind of feeling that, well, this is something else that can be worked with. Mm-hmm. I think it kind of opens up your mind to that creativity and to the fact that you actually have the ability to make things and make things move if you want to do that, if you feel you need to do that. Mm-hmm. So you have that open, kind of like that open mind, right? Because you have these skills. So you have this certain confidence, I think. It creates a certain confidence. I think maybe that's less so with the younger people right now. I mean, with the technology, that's a whole other issue, right?
And if you think of like technology, and that's something I wanted to even add, it's just that we weren't taught necessarily that all of these things, like understanding how to do the job of a seamstress, how to like do arts and crafts, all of those things involve technologies. They just happen to be other kinds of technologies that are not telecommunications oriented or happen on the screen, right? But they use tools, and those tools have a purpose. And if anything, they can exalt ourselves and others, and also our cultures. So it's very beautiful to just see how you both are remembering these times and even these kinds of very special things that you learned, that then it seems you also apply it later on in life in your professional career. But it's these little things from even, you know, your Salvadoran heritage, like just like these kinds of things from being fronterizo or just understanding the frontier. And I think that that's just truly special, because I think that that's what you did also, if you don't mind me saying, in a didactic way with the muralism work and with you helping establish Balmiali. So let's get a little bit more into like that, which I think it's very important, because your collaboration, as you said, you were roommates, which always is a very fun thing when you're younger, of course. How was that moment in which you were like roommates and started just even dreaming about, you know, what you would be doing like after a few years, or when you grow up, in quotation marks, because that's a thing that you think when you're that young, starting to be with friends and younger people that might be interested in things, and then you recognize that these things, oh, I'm interested in them too. How was that process of understanding yourself by being with Anna and understanding yourself being with Mia?
Yeah, well, I can say that when I came from San Francisco City College to, and I met Mia at 24th Street Place, the Tutorial Center for the Latina Children in the Community, 24th Street, right? I had been studying at City College. They had a great photography program. And so I was interested in photography. And one of the things that I remember was that as soon as I walked into the photography lab at City College, I smelled the developers, the chemicals, and then I realized, oh my God, this smells exactly like my padrino's photography studio in El Salvador. Because he, in our little neighborhood in El Salvador, we had a professional children's photographer. He had a studio, and so of course our parents would take us to the studio to get our photos taken, right? But it was like, I was maybe 2 years old, 2 to 4 years old when, maybe younger, getting my photograph at the Padrino's photo studio in El Salvador. And then when I walked into City College, it was like, oh my God, you know, it smells just like his studio. So there was that huge connection. So I was interested in photography, and I had done some at City College. And then when I went to meet Mia was such a creative force you could say. We're such creative doors. And I remember the house that, the apartment that you had on upper, she had an upper 24th Street.
Noe Valley.
Yeah. She had a little house there. And the whole space was so creative, the way she had it. Very nice, very creative. And so it's like, wow, I kind of hit the jackpot in terms of someone who had that creativity. And so Mia was there, again, working with the children, working in the arts. And 24th Street Place is actually, it was, actually right in front of, across the street from where Balmy Alley, mm-hmm. I don't know if it ends or it begins there on 24th Street.
We call it our beginning.
Okay, yeah. So Mia was like facing, I realized that. She was facing, Balmy Alley, just in front of her. And, her mind, I think, started working, developing what was going on there. And then, of course, we were only a couple of blocks from Galería de la Raza, right? So there was always that connection, you being an artist and me interested in photography and the photography artists from that exhibited at Galería. Adal Maldonado was one of them.
Amazing photographer.
Was like a genius, right?
Yeah.
Surrealist artist from New York, New Yorker.
Uh-huh.
Right? He was all Mr. Slick. And
we had never met anybody like that.
Yeah, that's right.
We had never.
Puerto Ricans, New Yorkers from New York.
And we're Californians. It's like East meets West in the most bizarre kind of way. But he was fascinating.
He was fascinating.
And all his geniusness, what it did, it just
was at the San Francisco
sparked us like crazy. And it was like, and it sparked me. I know it did a lot for you and your photography, but.
Yeah. And then, of course, there were a couple of other artists at the Art Institute. Irene was at the Art Institute. And then I went to the Art Institute for a short bit in the photography department. But looking back at it, City College had a much better situation. Lab. And they had very good photographers.
But it should be known.
So there were all those connections always kind of going back and forth.
But it should be recognized, too, that the San Francisco Art Institute was still pretty much an elitist situation.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
My mentor, Jose Ramon Lerma, who was bohemian and abstract artist, and he was phenomenal.
Yeah, he came from the abstract expressionist era.
Fabulous. And he was the North Beach group. He's one of the characters written in the book Brown Buffalo. He was amazing. But he was real guarito. He was very light. He's Mexican, but he's light. And he was the first one to tell you, he says, no, there was a lot of racism in many respects. We didn't call it that because it was this kind of a newer word, but it was clearly that people of color were not the most welcome people, and it was difficult for the young women to really get better leverage within that institution. They were able to do it, but it was a struggle. It definitely was a struggle. It wasn't necessarily the most open door policy going on.
Well, the San Francisco Art Institute, which is a major,
and it's beautiful,
major school, right, of art. Yeah, I think when Jose Lerma went there, which was in the late 50s.
Yeah, he was a 50s
abstract man. Expressionist era. So, what were there? Three Mexican students in
Miro. Miro, what's the other sculptor?
Oh, God, I can't remember.
It starts with an N.
I have to.
But
there were only about three,
of them. And he was one of the three.
He may be the only, Jose Lerma may be the only Chicano abstract expressionist.
He is the only one. And he actually graduated from that.
Yeah, and he did graduate.
Yeah.
Ernie.
Rivera, my cousin.
No, not your cousin, another. But anyway, there were like three of them. I have actually a couple of books that talk about the history. But then when our era came, when our generation came, Adal was there. He had come from New York. A couple of our Samoan friends, our Samoan artists, which were part of the Mission community, they got scholarships to go to the Art Institute, and then the Chicana women, Irene and did Graciela also?
And Patricia.
Okay, they also obtained scholarships to go to San Francisco Art Institute, which is an elite I mean, when you walk to the school, because I attended there, you walk to the school and you realize, oh my God, these, most of the Anglet people basically came from moneyed families. Mm-hmm. Because sometimes the kids, I guess, they didn't know what the heck they wanted to do with their lives, so they went to art school. But it was definitely an interesting experience. A lot of history there, too.
Lots of history. So, a little bit more on that art, San Francisco Art Institute. What was one of the struggles for the young women who became Mujeres Muralistas via Palmy Alley?
Irene, Patricia, Graciela.
And Graciela. Uh-huh. That their art form was so, it wasn't something that you could put in a box. So when it came time for their work, when they were doing their work, they didn't receive, it wasn't received with great open arms. They had to really kind of work with it. Because the professors or the art teachers or the instructor, the sense of Latino work was not as familiar. Now it's all over the place, right?
Yeah, but they had a different aesthetic, different backgrounds.
The sense of use of color, the use of style.
Yeah.
It was something that they were ahead of the curve. Except when you go ahead, you're also kind of
out.
You're pushed back and out. So it was a real struggle for them.
But you know what's interesting too about the art Institute is that there's a Diego Rivera mural.
Yeah.
At the Art Institute.
Talk about
so real. Again, you know, a connection that one would not anticipate, but you know, there it is.
Yeah.
I think I'm curious too, you know, since we're talking about community and your personal connections to the mission and to the city, I'm just and to the Art Institute and the community of artists there. I feel like a lot of these themes are coming into a moment of synergy, and obviously I'm a little bit aware of your work in creating Bami Alley and, you know, and talking about Las Mujeres Muralistas who were looking for ways to continue to be professional artists and get their work seen. I really would love to hear about the beginnings of the creation of Bami Alley. How did this come to be? How did it happen? Walk us through.
So all those factors were in place. Yeah.
So how it came to be actually was a trip I was living in Mexico because my family doesn't have direct roots any longer in Mexico. I needed to find out how to be, what Mexico was and who I am within it. So in our family, unlike Ana's family, who Spanish was never deterred, our family was. My grandmother, because of coming here, if you spoke Spanish, you were just like, we're not hiring, you're not here, you're not, you're invisible. So my grandmother, who never spoke Spanish, lived here for well over 50 years, was insistent that her children only spoke English. So everybody spoke Spanish and they
Excuse
could understand
me.
It.
Your grandmother never spoke English.
I mean, English. See, I can't even speak English and I'm trying to speak Spanish. That's why she's my comadre.
But if you think of it, the good thing of oral histories is that y es muy especial porque las dos están hablando and you're reconstructing memories together.
Yeah. Okay.
This is how we remember things, and sometimes we make a mistake that is still interesting. Like, why is it that we were thinking of Spanish? And of course, your relationship to Spanish itself, Mia, that's something I want to ask you about later. But let's continue in that thread of what is it that made this community even start in this way?
Yeah. So the reason why I'm bringing that Mexico experience was because I learned how to, I was exposed to a lifestyle of Mexicans in how they live. And I was in San Miguel de Allende, and I was also living in Celaya. I went there to dig ditches, actually, to bring water to a community that was pretty impoverished. For some reason, I had the good fortune for me to not have to do that job. So they put me in a more of a city. So I would, on Sundays, the families would go to the plaza. There's a plaza across the street from a church, and there's usually a gazebo in the middle, so where the bands would play. Families would sit around on these beautiful, ornate benches, and the young men and women would walk around the the little gazebo, men one way, girls another way. But what I was liking about all of that was the sense of the community, how families were together. It didn't matter if you were wealthy or poor or middle, whatever. Everybody was there. It was a place to communicate. It was peaceful and loving, playful, and all that sort of business. And I really liked that. And then I was learning about Dr. Atmu, who was a philosopher and a teacher, and he lived at the foot of the volcano in Cuernavaca. And what I liked about his sense of theory about education, art, philosophy, everything, was that everyone comes to a table with something. It doesn't matter if how educated you are, everybody has something. So he had a very kind of an open air school, so to speak. So you learn how to know that you are, it doesn't matter what you have, you're a human who's making a contribution to a community of choice. And so I always thought that was a really impressive. So when I came back, it was, you know, naive enough to go to a community. I said, I need to do something else other than working downtown, which is what I was doing. I used to work with an oil company, and that wasn't really for me, I realized. So I came to community work, and I was hired through another organization. Then I was able to separate and develop 24th Street Place. At that time, this is pre or early stages of bilingual education in schools. There was a lot of development of how do you do the books. There was not enough bilingual books. There was this and that. And a lot of children, multilingual or bilingual children, primarily Spanish-speaking children, were being diagnosed of having severe learning disabilities. We weren't going to accept that. And I said, that can't be possible. How's that possible? So that's when we decided we have to help do something here. So that's when we decided to, or I decided with this other person, he says, why don't you do a tutorial? Okay, what's a tutorial? So I didn't really know what that was. I assumed I knew what it was, but I did. So that's when we developed 24th Street Place. And that was became an after school and a summer program for children who were being misdiagnosed with learning disabilities. Yeah, there were some that did. But we figured this had to be a place that had to do with language and music and art. And one of the things I remember clearly that I came with my little brainstorm was that for a child to read red, know red, feel red, you had to express red. So I had gotten paint, and that's where this whole concept came to be. So where are you going to use this paint? Not just on a piece of paper or on a two-dimensional. You had to put it outside of yourself, outside of your body. Use your body in a bigger way. So that's when I saw Balmy Alley, which was right in front. It was beckoning me, you know. So then I had work study students and volunteers and other people that, and we did get some money. We had some money for employee people to work there, to like, let's do this project. Let's do this, create a mural project in this alley where kids can work with professional artists or young artists who are developing their art form and their professionalism as artists work together. Because they're the teachers to these kids. That's where they're going to know where red is. That's where they're going to know where blue is. That's where they're going to know how to blend and how do you make things work. And it was such an amazing experience. It was great. But we went beyond that, too. We also went incorporated theater and music and dance. And that was really fun. It was a lot of work, but it was the kind of work that was received with a lot of joy and curiosity. I think being useful like that, we didn't feel any constrictions, I don't feel. I don't feel we felt restricted to anything. And during that time, we're talking a few years or many years ago, there was no real, quote-unquote, borders around us, so to speak. You know, we weren't... The city is very conservative, you know, and it was also very proper. So when we were growing up, and I got to jump over to this one, when we grew up, going downtown meant gloves, hats, and proper shoes to go downtown. So there was a real sense of properness. So when it started to break away, I think post-hippie world, the hippie world sort of broke those barriers. So we were kind of like, hey, we were at the end of that one, but there it was there. So working with children was a real good vessel for us to, for creativity and thought, actually, to develop it, our community. Balmy Alley existed because the streets on Harrison and Shotwell were kind of, there was a lot of gangs. Let's just put it straightforward. There was a lot of kind of disruptiveness. Our kids, many of our children came from the projects on the other side of Garfield Park. And it was a hard place for them. So when they would come to us on 24th Street, they used Balmy Alley as their thoroughway, as their free space. But Balmy Alley was kind of was a mess. You know, it was a real mess. Huge potholes, broken cars, two-way streets. Can you imagine? Two cars, one... It's a one-way street. That park. And so our goal and our dream was to get the potholes repaired, repair some of those fences, and to get those cars off the street so that they wouldn't be parked there anymore, so that we could take it over. So we would be the ones who would be kind of what would be now is beautifying the street. The whole goal of that was to make it a place of safety and a place for families to walk up and down. Much like that experience I had in Mexico, where I saw the plaza was a safe place for families to congregate, to meet, and to be. And I think that's exactly how we started that, you know, so that it would be a safe place for kids. It was a lot of work to get permission for the to do the alley, though. I mean, it was a lot of work. We had no guides. We had nobody to teach us those. We were self-taught. We taught ourselves. And so I knew that you just can't go to that fence over there that's falling apart and just randomly paint on it. No, I had this insight to realize who owns that property. And that became a whole nother ball of wax, that one. It's like, oh, boy. So I created this questionnaire, and... I gave it to the trustee work students.
Me.
To go up and down, there was a few of them, up and down to each one of those houses on Harrison Street, 25th Street, down Balmy Alley, up 24th Street, down Shotwell, and around again. We canvassed so that they could went up and down those stairs to find out who the landlords were, or if they were the property owners, and families. And they would come back with, you guys would come back with stories about some of those families that we thought we weren't ready for. You know, some of the families were just, it was really rough. Multiple families in units, or fear that we were part of immigration and we're, no, not us. You know, we're just immigration.
Continuing in that vein, because it's very important, not only Balmy Alley as what it is today, but the specific decisions geographically, just the geographic area that Balmy Alley is in. On one side, on the other side, and what's in there, there were a lot of decisions that you made, and Anna and others that helped you made for Balmy to be strategically what it became. And as you were saying, you were self-taught, and this is something that you got some support, but you had to constantly be looking for that support. What were some of those things that you were thinking as the vision of not only beautifying Balmy, the mission and San Francisco, but also why is it that it has to be Balmy Alley and nowhere else? There's a very specific reason that I think I can say, which is kids and families. Why? Can you explain that to someone that is not familiar with the area?
As I had said earlier, Balmy Alley was right in front of the place that we were working. So it was our doorway in many respects, right? And we also, once again, it's that alley had to be that safe harbor. These kids were coming from public housing and the projects, and some of them came over the hill from the Alamany projects. So we had kids that had a life that I never saw, and they needed someplace safe. So in doing so, it was real important for us to make that alley a safe place. In doing so, we also found out who were the absentee landlords, and that's when I realized, well, how do I find out who the landlords? So I figured, oh, City Hall. You go to City Hall, you look in the beach, just get the address, because they had already the addresses. And I went to City Hall, and that's how I knew how properties, who owned those properties. Were those people actually from here, and were they not? And then to actually make a contact with them. And making contact with those landlords, many of them were pretty receptive. They said, why do you want to paint our fence? I told them why. Oh, okay. And your fence is falling down. Well, you want me to fix it? Well, if you want to fix it, you can. But we'll do what we can. You know, we're not going to rebuild. We're not going to give you a brand new fence. We just want to paint on your fence. So it was kind of an interesting process. I learned using that City Hall thing to get a place that on 20th Street, where we became roommates on 20th Street. That's how I found about that place. It was great, a fabulous house that I found and found who the landlord is. And he asked, how did you find me? And I said, I looked you up in the big book from City Hall. He thought that was really clever. So he goes, okay, yeah, sure, you can rent here. So, I mean, again, self-taught, things that you don't know what to do. And I think a little bit of that may have been a weird place of how, as immigrants, because I'm not an immigrant, but how maybe sometimes, you know, you learn things because you have to, or you want to, or there's a need somehow. And in this case, it was a need, we needed housing, and a need that I wanted to get our dream project underway.
Yeah, Anna, when you think of like the specific project and your role in it, do you mind describing exactly how you're helping Mia and the project, and also that part of your life, including, for example, the living with Mia, or like these kinds of very important interpersonal relationships that led to a very collaborative project? Because that's an interesting thing that I would like to hear from you specifically while working with Mia.
Yeah, I want to make a correction here. It wasn't helping me, because I'm like a finger on a hand. So I just want to have you rethink about that one. It was our organization was 24th Street Place. And I was the head of that, and it was something I wanted to do. But it was a dream shared. And so I think because we all had sort of that consciousness of wanting to work together. So I just want to help Cole correct that it wasn't, because it makes me feel like big mandona kind of thing. Sometimes I was, but sometimes you got to give a push. So it's a collaborative. So yeah.
Yes, and that's okay, because the assumption that I was trying to make was what you were saying, that it's more of the collaboration. It's more the implication that she's here with you and she worked with you and you were also supervising. So the great thing about this project is that we're constructing the histories of the mission through each one of your voices, and because it was such a collaborative interpersonal project, not only the murals but all of these infrastructure that got created with Balmy Alley. I love what you just said, because that is a very important emphasis of what we need, which is the larger spectrum of experiences. And you can speak of both things that Mia is saying. You can speak to your relationship to Mia and the organization, 24th Street, but also Balmy and your life also. What do you think of that time?
Well, I was a City College student, and no money, living on work study. So, but you could do it in those days. You know what I mean? With rents were so much more affordable, not just in terms of like inflation, but they just were much more affordable, especially in the Mission. Now, well, nothing's affordable. But so I was, a young student going to school, studying photography and other trying to prepare for four-year college, right, for university. And Mia was the director of the center. Mia does have great leadership qualities, you know. So she was a very good leader in that regard, and she did have this idea that she wanted to paint murals in Balmy Alley. Now, that was huge because Balmy Alley is it's a very ambitious program. It was a big idea. It's like, okay, go to every house. And, you know, all I cared was, hey, could you sign the paper? Because this gives us permission. Now, that was my thing. And as Mia said, the people living in the house, yeah, they go ahead. You know, they had no problems. And as you said, landlords didn't necessarily live there. And so she did that other research. But it was a big, ambitious program to paint every fence, backyard, whatever space wall was available behind, you know, on Balmy Alley, which was behind the two streets. So we did that. We got the signatures. There was, at that time, in our kind of have a little bit of a different memory about this, but I recall that there had been a mural in the Balmy Alley by Irene and I think Patricia. And so it's still there, as mm-hmm. you were saying. It's two like nymphs playing flute. Uh-huh. And Irene, she was so cute, right? She looked like a nymph.
She looked like one of them.
She's really cute. And you know what I think? I think the other nymph was Patrick.
Oh, could have been, yeah.
Yeah.
It could have been Patrick.
Remember Chinese?
I do.
Boyfriend.
Yeah, I didn't think about that.
He looked like a little nymph, too. But anyway, and they were friends. So,
tell me the last name of Patrick.
Oh, was it Patrick Fong? He's Chinese from Hong Kong.
Uh-huh.
I actually have a photograph of him if you ever want it. But he was good friends with Irene, yeah. And I think she painted, and he played flute.
Yeah.
So I think because they were friends, there are two nymphs there playing flute.
Back to back.
And then the mujer is actually, or Patricia lived in the alley.
She lived in the alley.
And Irene may have lived in the alley too.
Maybe briefly with her.
But there was, let's say there was the one. And Mia's ambition was to paint multiples. So we needed resources, right? Because where are we going to get? It's very particular paint. It has to be a high quality paint and many colors. So at that time, Renee Yanez, the director of Galleria, who had now established themselves there on 24th Street.
With Ralph Madriaga.
With Ralph Madriaga, who was assistant director. Well, Mia knew them, so, you know, she had communication with them, and I knew them because, you know, I wanted to exhibit there. But he was able to get, he liked the idea very much, and he was able to actually get paints for us to do the project. And at the same time, he was able to engage some of the professional artists. And as I reminded me, Carlos Lorca, who's a Guatemalteco,
yeah. Yeah?
But he was a professional artist.
Yeah.
And he actually came out to the day that the kids started painting one of the walls, he actually came out mm-hmm. and worked with the kids. And definitely you can see that it's not just a kid's mural, because then he would just direct them and do certain mm-hmm. things to make it more professional. So Mia was able to get those resources, get the help of Renee and and Ralph and the artists, and get the kids out there, like every day. This was during the summer,
yeah,
right? Get the kids out there to paint and get the professional artists to come in and work with the kids. And then as part of that, I was more instrumental in putting a performance activity. So we had the San Francisco Arts Commission, Neighborhood Arts Center, come down and lend us some stages, set up stages perform for performers. So then we had like the Samoan dancers, because it was a good-sized Samoan community here in the Mission. And then we had other young men, they had a singing group, remember? So they would come out and sing. So we had all kinds of activities, our performance activities going on at the same time that they were painting. So it did build up, as you were saying, a synergy. And it was quite surprising, as I was telling Mia, you know, that was, synergy, But somehow, some way, that energy just kind of grew and grew, right? Yeah. Then all of Balmy Alley had been painted. And artists started to see that as successful, and they wanted to now participate in reviving the alley. And that was over the summer months of, was it 270, we can't recall, 72, 73?
Yeah, it was like 71, 72.
Between that period. But, Mia had this very ambitious idea, and she was able to get people to come in and buy into it, get the resources, and then the artists really liked it, and they came out, and as I said, we had performers, and then the various communities, like the Filipino community, the Samoan community, of course, the Latino community.
In addition.
And so that's when we started talking more about, well, it's a third world community. And then out of that developed also the Mujeres de Aslan. Because it was interesting, the 24th Street Place was really run by women. Let's say Galería de la Raza was very male. At that point. And so, we were trying to kind of bring that consciousness about female into the picture, the bigger picture. Of course, you had the Mujeres Muralistas, who were establishing themselves at that time, and they were producing that summer. Mm-hmm. They produced a beautiful mural. I think I keep calling it Taco Loco behind the
McDonald's.
Behind the McDonald's. They did that really beautiful one. And, you saw the talent, right? And the skill, of course, they were skilled. They had gone to art school. But then that was the year, or after the summer, that we then went to Galleria and said, you know what, we want to have a women's art show. Mm-hmm. And so then Renee said, okay, that's fine. We can have one. And it was interesting. I was telling Mia that I don't know how many artists there were, 8 maybe of us. I have the names. But there was only, so all of them were Latino women. And there was Joy Sahuna, the one Hawaiian.
Our dear friend.
From the community. And so then we had to call it Third World Women's Art Exhibit. there was that consciousness of women as artists and women in the community. I think that became more clear, that women were trying to carve a space for themselves.
What I find real interesting about that is, it was Latina based for the most part, but we were also, because we had Joyce and we had other women, we were able to be more broad minded about them. So that's when, especially the women, the Mujeres de Aztlán, it's like it's more open and more less territorial, so I think that for me was, again, it was, we're all kind of that early stage of finding ourselves and definitions and finding what our community looks like, and that tapestry alone is something that I think that people didn't always recognize, that the collaboration to make something for a uniform unified base was something kind of new and exciting.
Also don't forget the sexual orientation the community.
Right.
That some of the artists, so some of the female artists were lesbian women, and of course some of the artists were gay men.
But
at that time, that was not like a forefront issue.
Yeah.
I mean, we knew it and we accepted it. It was fine, right? But it was not an issue that was at the forefront.
Mm-hmm.
So that developed, though, mm-hmm. later on, which I think was good. A lot of seminal issues were evolving at the time, including the gentrification, because I think you all know that once you get artists coming in, or not coming into the community, but let's say working in the community, and that becomes known, now, it seems that you could say we're opening it up to gentrification, and then that becomes a whole other social issue. And there were political groups in the community, the Mission Coalition Organization, mm-hmm. for example. They were very Saul Alinsky-esque organization that mm-hmm. was advocating for, let's say, housing, because most of the people in the mission community did not own their homes, right? They were renters. So they were advocating for people being able to buy property and, of course, jobs, and then problems with the police. That was really at the forefront, because there was a lot of violence from the police, right? They were very abusive.
Yeah.
So those were that were economic and social issues. The immigrant issue was not as highly evolved at that time.
No, it wasn't. Uh-huh. But it was still kind of in the underbelly.
Of course, because the mission was an immigration community, yeah. Right? A community made of immigrants. But, you know, activists, right? Latino activists. Mm-hmm. And the education, of course, that's how 24th Street Place got started. So those were issues that were very important to the community, and there were groups and activists working on those issues at the same time that we were looking at the arts as a vehicle for mm-hmm. social change and social justice.
In addition mm-hmm. just housing and jobs, police brutality, that was just...
Yeah, it was pretty bad.
It was pretty awful. I mean, what we're seeing now today, these forefront, yeah, it exists, but it was harder and worse during that time. Also, health. Health was another thing, and mental health. So this is also the beginning times of, again, the gender issues. It didn't, I mean, the men and women who were gay, it's like, okay, are you going to paint that or not? You know, it wasn't like an issue for us, because it was a fear tactic for them. They were afraid, some of them. Well, they thought we were going to accept them. Well, why would we not accept you? You've been here all along. Why am I going to close my door now? It doesn't make any sense to me. But I'm also bringing the health issue up, because this is also when the AIDS epidemic is starting to have its uprising, its plague, its unfamiliarity, its fear basing, and what it is. And when you have the AIDS, you're also having the gender issues. And so, but I think because we were at a time with so much changing happened, we just either incorporated it, or again, as Anna was talking about the MCO and with the Saul Alinsky-ish kind of philosophy, was kind of very, actually quite helpful. You know, it helped educate us, because where else are you going to get it? It was education on the street, so to speak, but through community activism. And the community was very powerful at the time, very, very strong. And it's also the beginnings of bilingual education. Bilingual education, can you imagine? I mean, that mm-hmm. was very important. And for me, it was a real concern about misdiagnosing children as being...
Well, I think the misdiagnosis, I mean, hits on the mental health. Mm-hmm. So with the children that we have in the families, mm-hmm. it oftentimes became obvious that the children were having some issues based on their family situations and the functional or dysfunctional aspect of their families, right?
Right.
I know that we had some families where alcohol was a big issue and what have you.
And sexual abuse.
Yeah. I think one of the problems that we had, though, was we didn't have any mental health services
No.
specifically aimed at, you know, bicultural, bilingual families. Mm-hmm. And that was a big deficit. And, we just didn't have any programs for them. And, my ex-husband, Ray
yeah.
Rivera,
right.
became very instrumental, starting at that time mm-hmm. in terms of changing the mental health services for the Latino and third world community here in the mission. So, yeah, he did a lot of organizing and got the director
great.
Fired because, you know, the director was in another generation, in another time. Just, I mean, it was related to the culture that was going on in the mission community and the needs of mental health mm-hmm. services. I mean, we're not even talking health,
yeah.
physical health. We're talking mental health services
health. This is the
in the community. So that was also something
yeah.
that was arising within the San Francisco Department of Public Health.
Right.
And, you know, San Francisco General Hospital is also here in the Mission on Potrero, and that was kind of, you know, big institution, but that didn't really relate to
the community
at that time. Yeah.
And it was also where, because of Ray Rivera and his advocacy for health and mental health, where Instituto de la Raza, which is a mental health institute,
oh, yeah,
here on now, with yeah, Ocho Sociedad, had to develop. And it came out of a Mission Neighborhood Health Center, which is on 16th Street. So little centers, little things had to develop in order to become more, have more advocacy for the people, the community, yeah, primarily focusing for Latinos, but open for everybody.
And at the same time, they had a artistic, cultural component to them.
Yeah.
So, you know, the things that I think were happening, let's say at Balmy Alley, mm-hmm, with this infusion of Latino artists and working with children and, mm-hmm, you know, Latino art themes, it's almost as if that synergy provided a foundation for these other things to blossom, mm-hmm, like the mental health services, mm-hmm, related to Latinos, but in a culturally appropriate way, mm-hmm, which there had been none of that before. That's why the prior director of, you know, the mental health program was basically
fired by
the community,
yeah,
itself, which was a pretty bold move.
Right.
But I think that kind of synergy, mm-hmm, within the arts community really, influenced even that.
Yeah. Uh-huh. It was a launching pad. I mean, literally, Balmy Alley became, something,
yeah,
Wimberly,
it was,
it became a launching pad.
Once it was established there and there was all that energy, mm-hmm, you know, and that interest,
right. Right.
It really was the basis of a lot of other things evolving, mm-hmm, and developing. So the arts can be, strange, right, that the arts can be such a powerful incentive, mm-hmm, for change. And I was just, you know, mentioning, of course, gentrification. It can also be a change for that.
Right.
You know, that, you know, just like everything else, it has... it has its ups and its downs, its positive and its negatives. But because it was interesting, right, at that time, you never saw a non-Latino or a non-third world person in the Mission. If you saw a white person in the Mission, that was really rare.
Right.
I mean, to see a white person walking up 24th Street or up and down 24th Street?
No.
No.
No. It didn't really happen. Yeah. Or they were touring.
Yeah,
they wanted to go to a Mexican
restaurant. Yeah, yeah, and even then it was a little unusual. But, you know, then again, that's the arts do open up, right, mm-hmm, the world. And it's a good form of communication, I guess, in that regard, too, because that's what you have now here at Balmy Alley. You have Balmy Alley continue to grow, continue to change, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Other people started working on it, took it over, and but it's it attracts a lot of tourism, and people from all over the world, mm-hmm, come to Balmy Alley to experience that.
This still remains the only alley in the city, I believe, that's completely painted.
Is Clarion?
I'm pretty sure.
Is Clarion?
Clarion does too, but it's more. I mean,
but it's not community.
It's not
like,
community
oriented.
Uh-huh. It's
yeah,
a different.
Whereas
different.
Balmy has very grassroots community,
yeah,
basis.
Yeah. And it also has that mission and vision of trying to unite these two parts of the city that are, of course, related geographically by Balmy Alley, where all of these families, all of these kids, all of these people would have to go through to get to the park also. And there's so many decisions that you both made that really made Balmy Alley this kind of special place, where not only are you talking about the Latino population in the 70s and 80s, which was the part where there was the biggest demographic jump of Latinos, but also all of these other people, Samoan, Filipino, just people that lived in the Mission. And I want to challenge you both to think of art not only as sustenance, but also as a catalyst, because that's what you did with Balmy Alley. It was a it's art. And it is useful and purposeful in really bringing about community, but also an awareness of who the community is and what the community stands for. And if you see the art that is depicted even to this day there, it doesn't have a lot of iconography that doesn't look like everyone in this room currently, which is something that is incredible, that doesn't happen often with a lot of other street art or other places that do have this kind of art form. So one thing that I wanted to ask is, when you started working in the project, and as you were also saying, it was primordially, even 24th Street, you were starting from women and children and non-binary folks too, but it was just so welcoming and so incredible to be able to collaborate in such a way that would bring about this change. I'm going to ask you specifically about one identity, two identities, which would be being a woman and being a Latina or Latinx. When you have those two things, how did those two things change throughout time in the 70s, 80s, and how you see it now? Because you gave us a good overview of even things that still we see to this day, the police brutality, all of these treatment towards immigrants. Just a couple of weeks ago, the Vice President of the United States said to Guatemalans, no, no, vengan, just don't come. It's still as present as it was back then. So speaking specifically about being a Latina, being a woman, how has that changed over time? How do you perceive yourself, and how did you perceive yourself even back then?
Well, I think opportunities have opened up, certainly, since we were back in those days.
Right.
I think we had, you know, a sense of confidence. Let's say myself, because my mother was such a strong person, such a leader, such a visionary, you know, et cetera, et cetera. She was very independent. I mean, she knew how to take care of herself. She took care of her family. And my mother never imposed limits, right? She said, don't ever say you can't do something.
I was like that.
Okay, Mom. If somebody asks you to do something, say you can do it.
I like that.
So I thought that was kind of funny. But that was her attitude, right? You can do pretty much anything you want to do if you set your mind to it and you work at it. So, I mean, I had that confidence. I think Mia did also, you know, she had attended, you know, she was an educated person. I was an educated
person too.
Yeah. So we had that confidence, but you didn't have the support.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's why we had to go, we had to walk up
those stairs.
24, yeah, and up to 24th Street and tell Renee, we're going to do this and we want you to, you know, help us, right? And he was very gracious. He liked the idea and he was supportive. And then I remember walking up even further up 24th Street, women, as mujeres de Aslan, to get the art show from Renee, that was the one, and then walk up further to get the Mission Media Arts, which was a group that was doing a lot with video, film, KQED, trying to open up KQED to do more community programming.
And training.
And to train.
Yeah.
To train Latinos to work in the industry, because that was pretty close.
It was close.
It was pretty close. And yeah, we did a lot of organizing around the media here in San Francisco. KRON, KPIX, KQED, KGO. Yeah, I mean, they had no Latinos working in their stations, in their programs. So,
and they weren't in the forefront. They were not your. They were not your weather person or your news person.
No, nothing. Latinos just weren't there. You never saw a Spanish name. Okay. Now you can tell the difference. It's, oh my God, look, there's a Spanish name. You never saw a Spanish name on any of their credits. Nothing like that. So then
As mujeres buenas, not mujeres buenas, perdón, mujeres de Aslan went up to Mission Media workshop and said, hey, you know, you guys need to incorporate more women into your program so that we can get into these stations. And actually, they were able to open up an apprenticeship program for some women. And I went to study camera work because, you know, I was a photographer, so I did study some camera work and media production. And, you know, I what was it? What was the station here? The
KQED.
Community. No, there was another.
Oh, no,
the KQED was big time.
That was the door we were really trying
there was a community
open.
Program here that still exists where we had this little show, and I was the hostess, and I interviewed artists and activists, you know, from Mexico and what have you down there. Yeah, I remember. And we produced a couple of videos. We also produced a video on the Mujeres Moralistas.
That's right.
Which I told you we have film.
Keep that one.
Oh, maybe, you know what, I need to share it with you all.
Yeah.
So anyway, as I said, I think women, we had the confidence and we had the capabilities, but we didn't have the support of the community or society in general.
Right.
And I think that's what we, that was like what we needed to work on further. I mean, I ended up going to law school after all of this,
right?
I graduated and I became an attorney and all. And I think when I went to law school, which is here, Hastings College of the Law, our class was the largest women's class that had been at Hastings. So, you know, these doors were opening. But I think very much a lot of us were pretty much on our own, and that we had to depend on other women who were, you know, working and active to kind of get us, you know, going, to give us the energy, to give us the courage to confront some of these spaces that were closed, you know, to us, and to walk through and make the adjustments to, you know, being in those spaces and being part of that.
Well, to have the right to sit at the table.
Exactly.
You know, to have the right to be able to have the decision making, to have the right to be the leadership.
Yeah, very. And we only had two Latino politicians.
If that, we were lucky.
In San Francisco. Yeah, in San Francisco, we only had like two. Actually, my ex-husband ran for supervisor because at one point San Francisco decided that they would go by neighborhood supervisorial.
Yeah.
And so then he ran for supervisor, and that was quite a show.
It was quite the beginning.
But I think we did get Latino. Yeah, we did. We got one. I forget who it was. I remember that our car got vandalized and then stolen during the election. Anyway, it was crazy.
Well, part of politicking.
But then again, you know, kind of pushing that because, there was only one politician or Latino politician, and then, but he was more like corporate. I mean, the people who supported him were, you know, wealthy interests. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, maybe one or two women supervisors in San Francisco. So you saw, before Harvey Milk,
no openly gay or lesbian women
politicians. So, you know, a lot of these institutions were fairly closed, and you had to make a lot of effort to open them up, which eventually, slowly, it has happened. But that was the very beginnings, I think, of that.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
I think developing our teeth or a balmy alley was really kind of a good stronghold for us. We did kind of an impossible thing. It was a monumental task, but we were pretty fearless. We didn't accept any no's. We just said, okay, we'll go to the next one. We would just work around it, but we were pretty fierce. When you have youth on your side, I think, and we knew there had to be a need for change, but we weren't necessarily going to duke it out with you. We were going to figure it out another way. We were using our brains, actually. And I think that that's what happened, because the women of that particular group were very smart, you know. And again, many of us were either students or self-taught. And if you don't learn that somewhere along the line, then you're not going to be successful. You know, you have to be... I think you have to have not have any fear, much like what you were saying a little earlier, what your mother would say. Like,
oh, yeah.
Her mother would say, just if they say you can do it, say yes. You can go eat with a cat. But
I'll figure it out.
You'll figure it out. Figure it out.
Well, that's what we were doing now, figuring it out.
Yeah. But I think we were at that point of life of change where things had to open up. It just had to open up. The 70s, I mean, you look at it worldly, a little more worldly, AIDS was happening. The post-hippie, the bohemian era was, they were already opening. The bohemians were kind of for us somewhere back here, influenced us and censored their poetry,
beatniks.
The beatnik time. The music, the poetry, the literature, the art. My mentor was in that generation. So, you know, they just kept going along, you know. And they incorporated politics within their community. And I think you can never separate that. You know, you can be bought out, I'm sure. Unfortunately, we weren't. We needed to have them buy in to us, you know. Very different. Very, very, very different, you know. It's just different. We all went in our different paths after a while. I think it was 2 years later, pretty much, maybe three, that we had to close 24th Street. I think at some point.
Well, that was actually another tragedy because the program was defunded.
When was this exactly?
75, 76, around that.
Exactly. Uh-huh. Yeah, because then it was exactly then.
Yeah, so that program got defunded. The Mission Coalition Organization was defunded.
Yeah.
And then with the school withdrawing the arts, music, and those kind of programs.
Art, music, and dance.
Yeah, all those non-academic programs, those got defunded. So you kind of have to ask, well, what was going on, you know? Why defund these at this time? It could have been, you know, that maybe there was too much activity within the communities, and they decided to cut that back.
It's a really good point, because what happened is that now the community has grown their strength. And so now they're not going to accept, I'm not necessarily going to accept the scraps anymore. We need to be this. We need these things. We need to have better education. We need to have our health services. We need to have a better eye on the police issues, you know, and there was those kind of things. So when you start growing you're fitting into your shoes better, you're standing up taller, then you're questioning the authority, and that was threatening. So you want to threaten us? We'll show you what we can do. Take the money away from you. We'll start eliminating, we'll start just taking monies away, less and less and less. So we lost our jobs. You know, we had to fold, we had to close. So many of us had to find another way to survive. And that's when we all sort of changed. But the time was also a critical. I don't know if was it Vietnam had already ended, or, you know, the war was
changing. Yeah, well, it was always there, right? It was always in the background during
San Francisco State strikes, UC, Berkeley strikes. I mean, you know, we love this story.
Well, yes,
Patty Hearst. We love this one.
Patty Hearst was in the Mission, you know.
She'd go to her.
She used to come to my mother's restaurant. My mother actually established a restaurant in 24th at Mission.
¿Cómo se llamaba?
Se llamaba Rinconcito Salvadoreño. Yeah. I think it was the second Salvadorian restaurant. There had been one before. It was still going on. But most of the restaurants were Mexican at that point. And then I think my mom established the second one. And and the SLN, right? SLN.
Yeah.
Yeah. Symbionese Liberation
Front.
Whatever. Yeah. And so, you know, Patty Hearst was, they discovered them living on Presida Street, which is in the Mission.
Yeah. And then they moved up to where my mother lives.
Oh, did they?
Yeah.
But when they lived at Presida, they used to come
down the street
to my mom's restaurant. My auntie would say, yeah, I saw her. They came to the restaurant. They had pupusas or whatever. I said, really? So, yeah. And then Mia said that a couple of our friends said, oh, yeah, we just saw Patty Hearst. I went to 24th
Street. Yeah, they were buying fruit and vegetables down the street. And then one of our friends, an associate of the 24th Street place, she came in. She says, I just saw Patty Hearst. I said, no, you didn't. She goes, yeah, I did. I saw Patty Hearst. I go,
you did not
see Patty Hearst. And she's looking at me, I did not see Patty Hearst. Because we knew CIA was undercover. We knew they were in the community. We knew that. We were very clear with that. We knew it. So,
and that had been like,
The
Black Panthers had been very strong before then, but they got shut down.
Black Panthers would park their truck in front of 24th Street Place, and then they would when they were doing free food, lunch stuff. So they came in one day and asked, can we park our truck in front of your store? I'm sure I'm going to say no. Why, of course. Well, we have these free foods that were boxes of food that we want to give to people in the community. Yeah, sounds good to me.
Free food.
Free food, boxes, yay.
So anyway, there was all that kind of stuff, going on in the background. But then the MIDI programs were
defunded.
Defunded, huh?
They were all defunded.
Education, the health programs, like the mental health, that kept kind of slowly going on. That was not defunded.
Well, they finally were able to hook up themselves with the San Francisco Department of Public Health.
Yeah. But yeah, so it's really weird how the elite leaders make these decisions, right? And how they then affect and why they fund some programs and not others is a big issue. Now, we also had BART at the time, right?
That was a big issue.
Bay Area.
Yeah.
A BART station was being built. Actually, there is a station next to where my mother's restaurant was. And there's a beautiful mural there by Michael Rios did a beautiful mural.
You can't see it because of the trees, but...
For my mom, it was kind of difficult because they shut off the street, and so getting into the restaurant was not easy, and, that affected business. But there were people who were protesting against the BART because what they were saying was, you know what, once you built the BART here and you're building it downtown, where that's where all the really cheap housing for... what are not maybe homeless people were. So you did, when they built the Moscone Center, they destabilized those group of people. And what the community activists were saying, okay, that group of people is going to start moving into your Mission now, mm-hmm. into the Mission District, which you see that now on 16th Street, which is the
pretty harsh,
the first BART station for the Mission District.
It also didn't do well for commerce. So businesses like your aunt, other businesses that were thriving businesses along Mission Street.
Because they closed the streets off for 2 years, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a amazing project what they accomplished.
Right.
But it always affects the smaller
progress.
And right now, 16th Street is a
hellhole. The dump is horrible.
I call it a pigsty, but
it is.
It's filthy, and it used to be a nice neighborhood. I mean, when I was a kid, we came to live in San Francisco as immigrated into San Francisco. It was a nice neighborhood. We used to go to the Breakfast Pancake House that was there, and it was
very popular place.
Yeah, and it was a little higher end. We even had high-end department stores on Mission Street.
That's right.
Including where McDonald's is right now.
Yeah.
That was a high-end clothing store.
Yeah.
And there were home goods stores that were also high-end.
You had the Arthur Murray Dance Studio.
And so all of that started deteriorating, I think, around the time that the BART was coming in.
They had like a Hales.
Hales.
We had Hales, was a great, and Mariners. They had these shops for us as Latinas. They had like the wonderful things and furniture. Mission Cultural Center was
the Shaft building.
But they were
it's high-end furniture. So if you look at the politics, I think in that way, in a historical way, you could see, BART is progressive in terms of, developing what is it, transportation. But then you realize, well, wait a minute. At the same time, we really did lose a lot. Mm-hmm. And we have not recovered from that. I mean, 16th Street is, there's no reason why 16th Street has to be
the way it is.
Basically as filthy and dirty as it is. I mean, all you have to do is send the guy with, you know, one of those little trucks. Send that person every day and clean up the place, okay? Just clean it every day. What's the big deal? But they don't. So you have to wonder, well, what the hell do they have in, you know, in the plans? And then some of our artist friends got commissions, right, for the BART station, those beautiful cutouts.
And Victor did that.
Yeah. But it's like, hey, you know, why don't you just clean up the place? That would do a lot for the aesthetics.
And health.
Yeah.
The health part of it is like, oh, God.
So that, you know, those things have really deteriorated for our community. Of course, now there are also more murals, more recognition,
and better, and nicer murals, actually.
Yeah, there are some very, very beautiful professional
murals. Beautiful
but murals. But for Balmy Alley, so I have, you know, a bone to pick with the city for Balmy Alley. It's like, Balmy Alley is like, okay, I guess it's kind of an open-air museum, you could say. Why not? Yeah. People from all over the world come to see it. There have been books written about it, constant articles about it, et cetera, et cetera. But the city has done nothing to improve it. I mean, the foundation or the road or whatever the hell is still that ugly old asphalt with some
broken... No, they kind of... Yeah. No, that part is fine.
And better. But I think they should, you know, invest in that.
Yeah, I
and there's no plaque, no recognition plaque.
We have to do the plaque.
Yeah, I think so. We have to push on them to do it. Yeah. But you know, I think it's like it's a great site, you know, for community. For artists, I mean, because it keeps evolving still, right? It's still evolving. But the city really doesn't pay much attention to it. Well, Galería de la Raza, you know, we worked at Galería de la Raza. Mia worked in the shop. She's fabulous in terms of her taste for picking out merchandise and then arranging it. She's just got a talent that's amazing.
It was fun
to do that. I worked there for a while doing a PR.
The PR and, person. But you did a good job there, though.
Selling, you know, trying to do this, the sale of artwork.
Let me say.
But that was also, you know, it's an icon, and we just lost that space, right?
Right.
And the city maintained, I mean, the city put money into it, but not what it really deserves, and, you know, for the importance that small gallery had.
Mia, you were going to say something, and then
I
can
ask you one question.
Oh, what I was
going to say, one of the things that was a really about Galleria, well, I mean, it was a good opportunity. And again, because they did acknowledge the fact that they gave that space for women to have women's shows. So they were kind of vanguards in many things. One of the things that Anna had developed was... we would have these artists now we've evolved and we have kids now, but then, and so one of the problems that was beginning to happen was that there were this growth of artists, primarily Chicana and Chicano artists, who were doing printmaking and silk screens, and but they didn't have an outlet. So I think it was a collaboration between Anna and I thinking, well, why don't we make this wall and put their original work on the wall so there's access. And again, it has things having to do with access makes a real big difference. So Anna made a great thing about promoting the idea of having artists actually have an ability and a capability and a forum to sell their work. I mean, to see a Carmen Gomez Garza print on a wall, we would have students coming for us far away as Fresno. Believe me, I know how far that is. To see this work, for them, it's as if they went to the museum and saw the original Picasso or Van Gogh, but it was their contemporaries. They said, is that really a Carmen Gomez? Is that really an Esser? Is that really a Juan Fuentes? Go, yeah. And guess what?
you can't actually buy it. So, you know, I think developing these various forums and places for people to look at things and have access to them is very important. It doesn't exist now. But now these are very established artists, so they have their own Facebook.
Yeah,
their Instagram.
Recognition, and hopefully we'll see the Mexican Museum.
Yeah, but it was launched through this. It was launched through with Anna's thing and working at Gallery and me being the person, buy it, kind of stuff. So,
I think something that, if anything, has become even the more clear, because I think it had been clear talking to other people that we've talked to before, you, Mia, and Anna, it's the fact that not only were women at the forefront of this and non-binary folks, it's the amount of strategic intelligence and intelligences in plural that you had that haven't been acknowledged. Because Balmy Alley is not only important for the mission, it's not only important for San Francisco, it really became something that is recognized worldwide and that really pushed muralismo and murals to become the kind of art that is respected also in other parts of the world. But it started here. It really became the crux of so many things that you both have beautifully explained and your part in it. And I just want you to acknowledge that importance, because I feel like we've talked to enough people at this point. And it hasn't been as acknowledged that as it should be. Because when you think of Balmy and you think of not only San Francisco but the importance of muralismo, it's thanks to Balmy especially that it became what it is. So let me just say that in case it wasn't something that you've heard enough, because I would like to say that. And I'll give now the mic to Maísa, who has a final question for the oral history. And then we can look at some photos, which would be fantastic, that you brought here.
So my last question was just going to be in thinking about what you all were just kind of discussing a second ago, and that there isn't any plaque. There isn't really very much the city has done to kind of memorialize the space in an official capacity, quote unquote. And so I'm just curious. I think my question is about legacy and how you think about that and how you think about what Balmy is today and the work that you did to create the space that exists today. And also just thinking about the importance of just legacy and visibility, I think, is what I'm thinking about too. And just having the community know that you too, you know, along with other, you know, team members, did this work and be able to put face to names. And I'm also just thinking about, like, young women who are in the space in Balmy Alley, knowing that women were at the foundation of the creation of this space. I think from a visibility standpoint, you know, if we're talking about, like, you know, you can't see it if you can't see it, like, when we're thinking about legacy, like, obviously that's incredibly significant. And so that wasn't really a question, but I think that's what I'm thinking of, and so I'd be curious to get your take on thinking about legacy in that way.
Well, I think I've actually had that thought about paying tribute to my tribute to the women, pretty much the comadres who established Balmy Alley. And I've been thinking about it for a long time, and I've been thinking about what kind of plaque is it. I can do it with the city. I'm gonna pay me and pay us to do what we're gonna do. But I've been thinking about what it would be, what the image itself would be. And I thought, well, do I do it in tile? So I've been already looking at that possibility, but I haven't done anything about it. And it really has to remain given the gratitude to the women who walked up and down those stairs, to the women who were there on a day-to-day business, working with the kids and what we did for the sensibility of the art and making the Balmy Alley
the success that it is. It was like, it was our dream. It was my dream, but it was with the support of everybody, and then it became a mutual dream. And I think it's real important just to establish that, to put it on the wall, because as the community becomes increasingly more gentrified, we are not having the ability to buy those homes there. A little house that maybe was 50,000 is like a million. You know, so our identity of the people who actually started that is beginning to disappear. And when I gave workshops these last 2 days, it was, I was happy to be in there, but it was kind of noticeable to me as well. And just telling Anna, I'm unfortunately starting to think about something we've got to do. She's like, oh, I can't imagine. But I think a tribute, some kind of plaque, I'm not sure what has to be there. And I don't want to go through a lot of problems with it.
It should be part of the history of the city.
Exactly.
It's actually the contemporary
yes,
history of the city.
Exactly.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I agree with you. And I really had not thought about the fact that it was very much a women-based project.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why that didn't occur to me.
I always thought that.
Well, you know, we were pretty open and cooperative, and like, yes, I said, got Lydia and Renee, and you know, some of the artists were male. But actually, too, because 24th Street Place was very much female, and we also cut some. We cut some
flat.
Some flat because of that too, in a way. You know, in terms of just kind of, I hate to say it, but misogyny. There were some misogyny issues about that. And that was kind of a weird feeling. But, so anyway, I guess because we're open-minded. And,
totally.
And, you know, but actually, yes, you're right. Because that's, Mujeres Moravistas was... Mm-hmm.
They were born there.
You know. Well, they were so... And they were so... they were so dynamic. Of course, they were so talented, right? And produced such beautiful work.
Beautiful
which
work.
Right now, you know, tragically, again, the first murals that they painted are no longer in existence.
The only mural,
and it was tragic because they were beautiful, very skilled, and they had more like the authentic fresco technique.
Exactly.
It wasn't just painting on the walls. You know, they actually were able to prepare, like Diego Rivera prepared his walls, right? And we've lost at least a couple of those.
I just want to say, given that exactly what she's saying, after we left. And we don't know how it got taken over. Who made that decision to paint that out? They were, and now that there's an attorney there who works with the art, it was unprotected. That body of work.
Yeah, it was at that time.
Yeah, at that time, art murals on the wall were unprotected. Now it's a whole thing. Now they're all protected. And when their mural got painted out, I think many of us either were not around or something, and we don't know who did it and why they did it. Because the mural that's there now, it's okay. But not right.
But maybe that's what the city could do. Oh, that's something the city could do, and to hire...
The city was not interested in.
You know, well, I'm saying now, to hire some of these very talented, let's say the Mujeres Moralistas, the artists are still alive for the most part, and to have them do more kind of professional work.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's an investment. They'd have to, you know, it's an investment, and it would cost, it would be resource, not huge amounts of resources, but that's where I see that the city and the general society, you know, doesn't respect, really, the contribution that these women artists have made. Whereas if maybe you were a man and you had, you know, a name or whatever, maybe it'd be different, right?
Absolutely. I think that
there's only one piece left, and that Irene's piece is still there.
That still says Irene's name too, and it's beautiful to look at it when we've passed by Balmy. And all of these things you've been pointing at are the institutional powers that be making decisions on who gets money, when they make money, and that's very important because And I think we want to end this oral history with this question, which is, Balmy Alley is so special, and the mission is so special. Like, even the sounds of the bus as we're hearing it, it's just, we're in it. We're in the street. We're part of it. And it's so important to realize that Balmy is what has also made the mission in San Francisco what it is, and to the world, and seeing ourselves. So I guess the last question, I'm going to ask it directly to Mia and then directly to Anna, is, what is Balmy Alley, or what does it mean to you? So let's start with Mia. Let's go then with Anna.
Balmy Alley for me means it gave me my rightful place of being a native San Franciscan, number one. It also gave me the rightful place to know that my family lived here in the mission for a brief moment of time. It gave me the rightfulness of a place of belonging and being. It also gave me a place to realize we need to make some kind of change here. Something's happening. I don't know what it was, but I think my intuition was telling me that something's happening, something's changing, and I want to be a part of that change or create the change. And I think they didn't separate themselves, quite honestly. So in doing so, Balmy Alley was an opportunity to use both creative spirit, education, working with families, children, the community at large. And it made, it really made a place for change. I wanted to see that change in terms of a safe place, a place where families could come and enjoy and feel comfortable. I think maybe it was naive in some ways, but I guess I was a little optimistic. And it meant a good thing. It meant a place to make, not my mark necessarily, but be a part of a community to make a community more important and feel value of themselves within it. And I think that was important. That was important for me, yeah.
That makes so much sense. And I don't think it was necessarily naive or optimistic. You have created it. You just, again, we just need institutional support. And it's good that this is a historical document that will be used if we wanted to make a case for it. And speaking of making a case for Balmy Alley, and not only the aspects of your work in Balmy, but also beyond, Anna, as a lawyer, as a woman, as a Latina, as a Salvadoreña, it's a part of the mission, even. What is Balmy to you? What does it mean?
Yeah, so as I said, that when we came to San Francisco, we moved into an apartment on 24th Street. It's above like a little bar restaurant, which was run by Puerto Rican folks there. And that's how my mom, you know, knew so much of the Puerto Rican community. And then, as I said, she had a restaurant there on 24th Street next to Phil's Coffee Shop. And we lived there for a number of years. The restaurant was there for a number of years. And so, you know, the place is important, right? The geography, as you were saying. 24th Street, of course, by then, I was no longer a child. I was a young person, you know, City College, not a university student. And so I think of Balmy Alley actually as a vortex of energy, you know, creative energy that somehow, I don't know, it's kind of magical in a way that it's just like, you know, this vortex of energy in this alley just was so powerful and tremendous, and it's still there. I think that in terms of the initiation, let's say Mia, myself, and, you know, like the woman, Muralistas, who I believe did the first mural there. I don't know. Can you say you gave birth to it?
Gave birth to it. Yeah, that was our baby. Our street name, Balmy.
Yeah, and of course, all the other people who came in, right? Like the kids and the artists and Galleria and who else was
the
there?
The dancers.
Yeah, the dancers, the singers, the people who came to perform, Neighborhood Arts Center.
the activists, the artists that were here in San Francisco at that time working at the Art Institute, whatever, all that just kind of, the energies just kind of came in, and somehow it's just concentrated, I feel. I mean, of course, all the mission, right, with all its other vibrant arts and all of that and everything that's happened. The Carnaval came afterwards, mm-hmm. Dia de los Muertos with Renee, more murals that have come into place. But somehow that vortex of energy, I feel, was so strong there. After we started with the mural paintings, yeah, and the performances, and it's just taken off. You know, as I said, it's kind of magical in a way. So that's what it means to me. Mm-hmm. And I hope that, yeah, we continue. I think the artists are continuing to support it. The community continues to support it. I think politically we need to get that going too.
Yeah, I think it needs to.
Politically and economically. You know, after this COVID thing and where you shut down the whole world, and then, of course, you know, we had Trump who was president. How can a man like that ever become president? But what I've learned is that, you know what, and with our experiences, damn, anything is possible.
Absolutely.
Anything is possible. And when the city tells you, oh, no, we don't have money for this, for that, what do you mean we don't have money? Of course we have. You can see it. You know, you can see the spending. I mean, where did this money come from? Mm-hmm. And they're always coming up with new projects that they want to fund. Where's that money coming from?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Uh-huh. So I think we have to even look at our society and our situation in a much even broader way. In a much more open way. It's like, you know, a wake up. We have to continue to wake up, to see what's really going on around us.
I think what's happening right now, because of COVID and how the world shut down, I think the sense of fear and poverty has gotten real difficult for people. And I think people are still very afraid. The sense of community is real difficult, with the exception of Roberto Hernandez, who's really done a tremendous job, you know, doing the food hub and things like that. But people wanting to put back, and his carnival, people wanting to put back in the way what we did, I don't know that it could happen again like that. You know, I don't think it could.
I think what you were saying about being young at the time is that you do have a sense of freedom. And at that point, when things were so moving here in the mission and there was that political and artistic activism, one did have a feeling of much more freedom. Mm-hmm. And I think society now doesn't feel as free.
No.
It feels actually quite closed.
Yeah.
And so that's affecting us in certain ways. But as I said, how can you have the power to shut down the planet, basically, what they did with the, you know, with the COVID pandemic? And what happened with the economy and money? What is money? You know, you're almost questioning it now. And why are our politicians telling us there is no money for this? I mean, that's all I've heard my whole life. Right? Oh, there's no money for this. There's no money for that. There's no money for education. There's no money for the arts. Okay. But, you know, what's going on now? You seem to have a lot of money to do all these things.
Yeah.
You know, in fact, I see no limit to the money that you have to distribute when you want it, the way you want to distribute it. So, hey, how about getting up, you know, taking care of Balmy Alley?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, they could start an endowment fund.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, they could do an endowment fund. An endowment fund to do more beautiful murals in the mission, because, you know, the mission is very vibrant. Mm-hmm. You know, it produces money for the city.
Absolutely.
I mean, you get tourists coming here, you've got all your neighborhood eateries, you've got your bars. I mean, the mission does produce money for the city.
Yeah.
But I don't think we're getting the share of those profits that will uplift our community, that will beautify it, that will make it healthier, that would clean the streets on 16th Street and Mission. Even the BART station, come on, the BART station. What does it cost, billions of dollars?
To just run. We'll take that public transport. I don't take any public transportation.
Yeah, but I'm saying that I think our community is being cheated big time. It's being cheated big time, and it's not getting what the revenues that it needs to make it a beautiful place to live. Mm-hmm. It could be. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's
certainly, yeah, and certainly the arts have made a huge contribution. So that's a proven
right
at this point.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, we have to be careful not to take a no for an answer, right? Get that youthful kind of, mm-hmm. well, anything can be done.
Right.
Not let the powers that be limit us in the ways that they are limiting us so much more. And impinging on our freedom, you know. And what we have is we have our creativity, we have our minds, we have our experience, we have our knowledge, and yeah.
I think that's a perfect note to end on. And you also were mentioning just possibility, right? Like if someone like Trump can be president, then the possibilities are actually endless.
Hey, I could be president.
Right? And that's
run.
An important thing. That's an important thing to acknowledge, that even all of these ideas that you're having, possibly an endowment, possibly talking to the city and city restoring, helping conserve some of these murals, these are possibilities that fortunately today, thanks to your trailblazing work, are clear. And if they weren't clear before, and these will be used as these oral history is that it's a recollection of a lot of your stories, a lot of the things that you decided to share with us, which we're truly privileged to just be able to record them and hear them from you. But this is a document. This is something that we can use to get that
true.
Change. And just to finish, we wanted to thank you for sharing these stories and for your time.
Thank you. Yeah.
As we finished the oral history, Anna had brought some pictures for her and Mia to reminisce about their time being roommates and to remember how their friendship has endured since then. What follows is an audio record of what they showed, Maisa and I.
This is just so when I was studying photography at the Art Institute, I took some pictures of Mia when we were roommates. And so I was showing them to her.
This is fun.
I think we have a copy.
I don't know why I decided to put the clock on that stand.
It's black and white.
I guess it was the
and
time.
So this is the other. This is the other image.
I look like a Mexican girl.
You do? you look like a Baroque. You know, doesn't she look like, como se llama? Ella. Wild.
I look wild.
Oscar.
Oh, yeah. There
so these are just the same picture, just different exposures and what have you. I think this was my bedroom, huh?
Yeah.
I was going to ask you, you took it there when you were both roommates? Or
we were, and it was my bedroom.
Yeah.
It was
a beautiful house. The house we lived in is on 20th between York and Bryant. And the house, the front entrance is the house. From the street is actually the back entrance.
Was it a carriage house, Mia?
Yeah, it was moved from the Best Foods Mayonnaise at the time on Bryant.
Was it moved?
And they moved it from there, and they didn't know how to turn the house around.
This looks good.
So this is a good spot, so they pushed it in that way. So the back of the house is the front of the house. The front of the house is actually the back, and it has a huge, it's as tall as that. For carriages, because it was for
I guess it was for horses.
It was for horses. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a
great
place.
I remember we used to have parties there. We used to have a lot of parties. And one time we bought remember the beer keg. So somehow I don't know. Oh yeah, the beer keg, and then we didn't finish it, so we had that beer keg out there for weeks, and we were drinking it.
We kept drinking it. It was working. It worked.
It kept working. It kept working.
So this is Esther Hernandez,
cool,
and Renee, and this is Anna in the back, our glamour
Esther,
queen.
Esther, this is a couple of
this is Esther. Esther Hernandez. She's one of and
she's
came as part of the group eventually with the Mujeres.
Well, yeah, she was in the art show, Third World Women's Art Show.
That's right, and our glamour lady.
Oh, yeah, I didn't even recognize myself.
She goes, who's
that?
Is that
Joanna?
That's you.
I know, it's me.
I showed her these yesterday.
I remember the outfit.
Of course you did.
I wore that thing.
This is an artist who came much later when we worked all together at Galleria de la Raza. An extraordinary art. You had something about you were telling about her.
Oh, I have. Well, wait a minute. Don't you have a picture of her work?
This is one of them.
So Eva was the sister of the... Lorraine, who was the director of the Mexican Museum for a few years. And this is kind of her artwork. She was a fabulous
chalk artist. Unfortunately, she had passed away, and so this is one of the pieces I did at the art commission. And she did a big star on the sidewalk, and I did a star on her star with the marigold flowers. But she was an extraordinary artist.
It's a beautiful altar. Like, you're like having your friend. That's an important part of also like your both of your works. Like when you were doing even Encantada, like that was such an important
Mia
part of your heritage.
Yeah.
Mia is
an
extraordinary altar maker.
These are like, I really like these because she always worked on a ladder always.
Yes, that's right. And you know, it's so.
So I did her ladder.
What Galleria? I think Galleria did it after the. The Palmy Alley, where they took over the Foster sign, and they started painting a mural there for every new exhibition. That went on for years, and Eva painted many of those.
And they eventually surrendered that. They kept coming and painting them out, and then we would paint over, and do it again, and then they said,
we're tired.
You can have it. So this is you showed that one, right? So this is one of the women. This is Martha Estrella.
Oh, Martha was nice.
And she was part of the 24th Street Women Clan. And those are actually some of the kids who are grown up, because we try to do a little memory lane with that. And it's some of those grown up kids have their children.
Yeah, they already have children.
So that was in the Palmy Alley.
Right, by Almy. Palmy Alley.
Mm-hmm. Palmy Alley.
It's just incredible to see like those specifically beautiful smiling faces and the heritage that they were able to see in Palmy, but also just passing by it and what you did with your organization. It's just incredible that you have that also as a document, as a record.
They're
part of that, huh?
They're
part of that history. I mean, the kids were
I mean, we were
drawing and painting.
I think I know had many more photographs,
but
I was
in a
fire.
That's
Harvey's
fantastic.
The boa.
La boa. It's green.
I think it was purple.
It was purple.
Oh, on top of that, it's purple.
Let me put this one on. Yeah, whatever. What happened in Balmy Alley, too, because of the music, this was a beginning where Malo, very well known.
Oh, my God. When we talked to Mike Rios, he was playing guitar.
Oh, Mike?
And
he was
incredible. Like, we were listening to, like, very old
Malo
records.
Oh, my God.
He had a stroke.
Yeah.
He was a musician then.
He considers himself also a musician, which was a nice thing when we talked to him.
Yeah.
But it's just... kind of beautiful music
about
Malo, just like the guitar, the strumming,
those
tambores, los congas, los timbales.
So he,
he's multi-talented.
So when Malo was just developing, they played music in the alley. So we go, oh yay! So we were very flattered.
Let's get Santana.
I think we tried, but he was always touring, so we couldn't.
He was
busy. Our other friend was Taj Mahal.
Yeah,
hey.
Taj Mahal.
So
Mongo Santa Maria.
Mongo Santa Maria. So Taj would come to 24th Street Place tall man. And then he'd come in and we'd go, hey. We were like all like starstruck. And after a while we got over it. Because he would just come in and he would just play his kalimba. We're going, okay, go ahead, sit over there, child. We're just busy now. Coolest person ever. Yeah. And then we had Mongo Santa Maria. I don't know how that happened, but he came in. And Natalia. He got a little crush on her.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I thought it was Martha's one.
And then they came to 24th Street Place. And that was fun, too. And then they came to when we had this fabulous house on 20th Street. And he brought his band.
Oh, yeah, to one of the parties.
Yeah, and he made the party, actually. He played music, and we were like, this is fun.
This is nice.
We have a great time. This is nice.
That is just beautiful. And it's just like, you know, you're referring to Mike and them like as multi-talented.
Yeah. Oh, God, yeah.
Excuse me, you both are multi-talented.
Thank
too.
You.
Because it's not to, you know, it's not enough to just do 24th Street. You then did Encantada, then you became a lawyer. And it's incredible, all of these talents and intelligences that you also have. That's
sure.
why the community is what it is today.
Yeah, and I don't think I'm unique to that, you know? I would like to see more of that developing.
I'm with you. It's not unique, but it's because we also don't tell ourselves that we can aspire to do all those things.
Yeah, and we need encouragement and we need that support. I mean, if you look at mostly famous people and whatever, it's because they have gotten. It's you don't just do it on your own.
Never.
You know, you need that societal support. Otherwise, you're basically marginalized, yeah? Mm-hmm. Because we all know lots of beautiful, talented people. We didn't talk much about the Mission Cultural Center, but that came after.
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh.
That was a big struggle, but it was a good one.
That one worked well, and that should be... Arts Commission has supported that for
They get
years,
money
right?
and hotel tax money.
That was a source of funding. That was good.
Yeah. So we did go on. I mean, I got picked up by with Asawa and to work at
Asawa.
Remember?
Yeah,
she liked what we were doing. And then it was where we lost our fund, and she said, "Oh, well, come work with me." So okay. So I worked at Alvarado Arts.
That did happen.
It did happen, yeah.
That is incredible because sometimes what I've heard is that, you know, like Ruth did know of some of these, but these are the little parts that we didn't know about the history.
Yeah.
You worked with her at the school district.
Yeah, I worked with the school district.
When you got a job there after 24th Street.
24th Street, yeah. And I was able to get contract and work with them. And they wanted me to work with them. And then I worked with, that was a big project. I loved it. It was, what was their name? San Francisco Youth Arts Program. And what it was that it was a huge event to have an art exhibit of children's art in Golden Gate Park and at the De Young Museum. And that was...
Oh, yeah, you worked on that.
Yeah, I worked on that. That was phenomenal.
The refrigerator.
Oh, plug in the fridge.
Oh, good thing.
Oh, yeah.
Can you
that's
imagine
how we have the attorney like, oh, and it's not on. We'll never get that heat ever again.
You'll never. So, mira, quédate tú con estas.
Oh, thank you.
Mm-hmm. You might be able to make a collage.
I've been doing that a lot
with photos.
I did one.
Cutting them out.
I did this one. I think you gave me one. And mm-hmm. I put this little decal of a donkey, a burro. With a sarape, and I really liked it.
I've been working on a lot of framing things, reframing them.
Well, I'd like to come and see your things.
This oral history of Mia Gonzalez and Ana Montano was a collaborative effort, like murals also are. The team behind it was
Erica Gengzi,
Maisa Plunk Graham,
who served as executive producers,
Natalia de la Rosa,
who served as a production assistant,
Javier Briones,
Kevin Carr,
Chad Curver,
Carrie Cordova,
Stephanie Garces,
Melissa San Miguel.
And it was produced and mixed by me, Camilo Garzón. The Mission Murals Project was organized by the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art and funded by the Institute for Museum and Library Services. Thanks for listening.